ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corbin Middlemass and Ed Cowan, for your Monday. A couple of days out from the Adelaide Test. It is a must-win test for England. Obviously, 2-0 down in the series with Australia, the current holders of the Ashes. The BBL is underway and we have crowned a champion in the WBBL. My name's Corbin Middlemass in Melbourne. Ed Cowan is in Sydney. Teddy, it's great to see you.
Corb, awesome to see you too. It's moments like this that when you see faces on the other side of a Zoom screen, you're grateful for it. So a bit flat up here in Sydney, to be fair.
Man, I can only imagine. And I was, you know how much I love the city. I was lucky enough to live there for a couple of years, and I mean this rings bells right around the country. But it's a day we're going to remember forever. And I know people tune into podcasts like this, into the sporting world as a distraction. From what happens in the real world. But I think more than anything, people crave a sense of togetherness and a sense of community. Mm. And I think that's something that we're desperately obviously trying to get back as a community more broadly. And my heart breaks for the Jewish community, for everybody in Sydney, and just those terrifying scenes at a place that is so familiar, that we know so well, and is a place of so much joy for so many people. And I can't even begin to wrap my head around it.
Well said. I think everyone's still in a bit of shock, and it will sink in, and our hearts will continue to break, no doubt. But as you said, sport can sometimes play the role of not only distraction but bringing people together. So
yeah,
it's nice to talk some cricket on a Monday.
No doubt. No doubt, and we'll do that. Before we get into it, Teddy, just to talk about sport and an uplifting story. I know you don't follow the NFL as closely, and we're not that kind of podcast, but there was a story this morning in our time in the NFL where after 1,800 days, a 44-year-old grandpa returned to the NFL. This is a real story. It sounds like something straight out of Hollywood, but a guy named Philip Rivers, who has 10 kids and one grandchild, having been absent from the sport for 5 years, was called up basically onto the squad during the week to play for the Indianapolis Colts, who led the division leaders in the Seattle Seahawks until the waning moments, and in the end, the Seahawks got home by a whisker. But this guy, basically off his couch, who hasn't played in 5 years, Teddy, jumps out there and plays in an NFL game and really holds it down and played a pretty serviceable role as the quarterback.
I thought you were going to say he was like the big bulky line
backer
that just stands there and kind of gets in the way.
Or the punter or the kicker as the quarterback. So he comes back and quarterbacks an NFL game. I mean, I'm trying to think of a scenario, and the only one I could come up with, imagine in 5 years' time, if Uzi retires in the Sydney Test, he returns to the Australian cricket team and all of a sudden, opens the batting and plays a starring role or whatever. Like, How long are you retired, Teddy? Imagine if you walked out there tomorrow and said,
That's what I was thinking. I threw out in the podcast, I'm happy to open the batting in Adelaide as a joke. But evidently, I was thinking about playing with my little nephew on Saturday in fourth grade for Sydney University. Yeah. And even that was a little bit of a stretch. I was thinking, do I want to embarrass myself and do that?
But even then, you get the chance every, not that you play regularly or anything like that, but if you wanted to, you could play community cricket.
True.
In American football, there's nothing like that. It's not like you can go and play in your park team or whatever. Like, you're retired at 39 and then 5 years later off the couch plays in an NFL game. And incredible, incredible scenes. Just a little uplifting sort of feel-good story in the world of sport. The Ashes, Teddy, and England, of course, it is a must-win test match for them in Adelaide. They were in a familiar position back at home in 2023 and obviously ended up in a draw. They ended up winning two of the remaining three test matches. This is a whole different kettle of fish, though. They're playing an Australian team that has lost once in their last 11 outings. They need to beat them three times in a row at a place or in a country where they haven't won in their last 17 test matches. They're significantly on the wrong side of history, including the stat that we've quoted so many times. There's only been one team in the history of the game, not in Ashes history, not in Australia and England battles or whatever it turns out to be, or either country's test history, in the history of test cricket, 149 and a half years, only once has a side come back from 2-0 down, and that featured Bradman back in the Depression. So They're pushing against a whole lot of history, Teddy, England, to try and get themselves back in the series from here.
Oh, and I'm sure they've gone all Ted Lasso, and there's a big sign that just says believe. And you've got to touch it on the way out. But the tracks that you just lay down suggest it is fat chance and none that they come back to win the series. So the best they can hope for, as you've probably laid out, is a 2-2 draw. But I think the chances of that happening are many, many thousands to one. The way they're playing, the way the Australians have found a little bit of groove and probably not played their best. So England have been poor. Australia have been good in patches and have been good enough, but not probably as dominant as they could have been, to be honest. And they're only going to get better with 800 test wickets coming back into the team on a ground that suits their style of play. I mean, this is, I'm sure you've probably done your work here, the Adelaide Oval, tough place to win for an away team, particularly, you know, since it's gone to a drop-in wicket.
For England, they can't get two before they get one. So first thing is, got to win here in Adelaide. Try and keep the series going as long as they possibly can. Brendan McCullum did media a little unexpectedly. We don't ordinarily hear from McCullum between tests or at this particular juncture, but he spoke a few days leading out and basically was asked a question about whether they would field the same top seven. There's been so much speculation about, you know, Jamie Smith's spot in the lineup, Ollie Pope, so on and so forth. He quickly clapped back, "I would have thought so." He went on to say, "For us to go on and win the series, it's not about throwing out what's been successful for us over the last few years. It's about having more conviction. Knee-jerk reactions and chopping and changing a settled batting lineups is not really our way." So basically, you can lock in the top seven. Doesn't sound like there's going to be any change from there. He also left the door open for Bashir and Tung to play. So there's every chance we see them for the first time in Adelaide. And was also asked about the speculation around his job. He basically said, "Look, it doesn't really bother me. He's contracted through to the Home Ashes in 2027. He said, "I don't coach to protect the job. I coach to get the best out of people." So McCullum gave us a little bit of clarity on a few fronts there.
Well, I like his last comments. I think the only way great coaches and dynasties of teams exist is when they take the short term out and actually play for the long term, and the short term results build in your favour and you actually can create something special. If you have a coach thinking about a game to game proposition in terms of their own longevity, you're in big trouble. And we see that a little bit in state cricket, to be fair. There's a tension of developing players to go on to play for national teams as opposed to winning Sheffield Shields. And there's a different dynamic, obviously, in the international cricket, but I am familiar pretty closely with it, and he's doing all the right things. Working backwards, Bashir and Tung, I think both will play. I mean, what's the purpose of having a spinner if you're not going to play them in Adelaide? You know, that... You know the ball's going to grip and bounce. There's going to be grass on the wicket. How much? Probably 6 mils, I think. They reported 8 mils the other day, but that will come down. The ball will turn day one, probably more than it turns day two and three, and then it will turn day four and day five if we get that far. The ball will grab day one. So with that in mind, and their propensity to generally bowl first, they haven't done it on the last two occasions, but there's a world where Bashir is actually more effective on day one in Adelaide than maybe any other day in the series. Mm-hmm. So that's an interesting dynamic for sure. And I think their bowling, as we've talked about the last two or three podcasts, needs a little bit of a shake-up. They're short on the ability to just execute on a plan.
Yeah.
And then as for the top seven, I kind of agree with the sentiment. They do have their best seven batters. But what I don't love is it is ignoring some current signals, and that is lack of confidence, lack of runs. It's a hard bet to then say that's going to turn around just through, you know, the understanding that they may have superior skills. So I don't necessarily love that, but I understand it.
Yeah, I get it too. And to be honest, I'd probably be doing the same thing. Like, as much as everyone talks about Jacob Bethel like he's the second coming, guy's played 3 red ball games this year. That's it. We're in December, and he's played 3 red ball games. And this is also a guy who doesn't have a first-class 100. I think he's got 1 pro 100 anywhere, which was, I think, playing an ODI game for England. So
I wasn't thinking Bethel. I was thinking Jacks.
Jacks in the seven and rejig things a little bit.
But, correct.
But even Jacks, I was thinking more about this after our chat the other day, and it reminded me of that Ricky Ponting quote, you know, where Kevin Peterson's pressing him about, that they were all at sea, they had no idea. And I thought the same thing. I was like, okay, he got 40 and he's out. Like, it's a little bit the same with Will Jacks. We got very excited, and it sort of looked through his scores. He got a bunch of 30s and a 40 here or there or whatever. But Brennan McCullum also was pressed about, the comment about, we're almost overprepared. He said, there's no perfect preparation. If there was and you could hit 4,000 balls to guarantee an average of 90 or bowl however many balls to guarantee 10 wickets, then we'll do it. Don't worry. But that doesn't exist, really, backing up his comments. And it went on to basically say, I'd rather people be talking about me and my comments than talking about the team, which, maybe there's something in that. The other thing I don't know if you saw was the altercation at Brisbane Airport involving the security member of the England team pushing and shoving a cameraman, and there was a report that came off the back of it, and everybody else was watching on thinking, what on earth's going on here? And you could tell the look on the English players' faces thinking, how are we in this particular scenario? And yet, I don't know how much that's actually going to disrupt a dressing room or what happens when that kind of stuff goes on. Teddy, you've been in there in a camp. I'm sure you would have seen the odd little fracas here and there.
I've seen some disruptive things in my time. look, I think when you're in the bubble, you actually start believing the bubble exists. And so I don't think they would have thought too much about that little moment there. They would have thought they were in the right for whatever reason. I haven't really done much work on it. The only comment I do have, as you're kind of asking for reactions, I've thought more about this preparation thing. And I guess I know from my own experience, there is such thing as overtraining. And I always felt, particularly at that level, the temptation is to do more. When in actual fact, you want to leave a little bit of mystery, a little bit of energy, a little bit of excitement for the contest. But that's relying on a corpus of work underneath. And I guess when people, their ears prick up to say they've been overtraining, they find it hard to believe given all the other data points of one tour game. They were only here a week before Perth. They were being resold over in New Zealand. It's not as though they have set aside months of preparation and then they've baked the cake and they just got to whip the cream and put the strawberries on top. They're in the kitchen trying to find the recipe. They're adding flour and milk and water and stirring like bloody crazy. And so I think that's where people kind of find it hard to reconcile the comments. But the actual philosophy, I agree with. It's just been how that's been implemented. From what we have seen outside in, I guess.
And it might not be a certain number of balls or whatever it turns out to be to get success down here, but success leaves clues. I mean, look at what India did. India have had success here, South Africa. Look at their preparation, and clearly what India have been doing is working. So they haven't done any of that. So it makes you sort of think, well, is that the perfect preparation when, this has been a hard place to come and win historically, and yet the sides that have had success previously here have all done something similar. Can I just talk about the venue? So Adelaide Oval, and keen to get your take. So it's one we absolutely love. I can't wait to get back there this week, and just almost what a modern sporting stadium should be, where it's got the perfect blend of the old and the new and the old scoreboard, and I absolutely love it. I love going to Adelaide.
I've got a little secret for you, Corb.
Yes?
But don't tell anyone.
You're not going to be there, are you?
No, I'm not going to be there.
Oh, that's
my favourite ground in the world.
Yeah. I can understand that.
It's a special place.
Do you know what it is? It's what the SCG should be. So the SCG's got to somehow get that balance right between, when they get rid of the Barongal stand and what's the O'Reilly stand.
For those that haven't been to the Adelaide Oval, the way they reconfigured the arches brick by brick, it cost them a lot of money invariably. But as you say, the fusion of old and new, of melding history with modern, it's gorgeous. Absolutely spectacular.
Now, one thing that leaves us with a pretty small sample size is the fact that this is a red ball test match. So it's a day game. This is what South Australia wanted before Christmas. And really a lot of the thinking from the government was, more people will pour into the streets. Interestingly, if you put your finger in the wind and talk to a lot of people on the ground in Adelaide, they're not that happy about it. They would rather it be a pink ball match. And they feel like they got enough traffic both pre and post that actually sustained the restaurants and everything else. But for whatever it's worth, It's a day test. It's only the second time in the last decade. So 8 of the last 10 have been pink ball matches, which means, Teddy, if we sort of pore over the data here, wickets have fallen at a quicker rate in red ball tests than pink ball tests over the past decade. So we're looking at 8 test matches versus 2. And I thought, oh, maybe that skewed a bit. Was that all-out 36 red ball test? Nope, that was a pink ball test. So that doesn't even contribute to the data, which I thought it was, the India test. I went back and checked on that. So if you look at basically at the red ball tests that have been played over the last 10 years, only Belgrave Oval is a harder venue for players to score test runs at than a red ball test in Adelaide. So the average wicket over the last 10 years, SCG 36, MCG 30, Gabba 28, Adelaide Day Night 28, Perth 27, Adelaide Day Game 22, Belgrave 18.
That's 22?
22.
Wow. That's, I mean, you're doing your job. I mean, that's, it talks to a couple of things for me. You know, my reaction is kind of off the cuff. The wicket suits pink ball cricket because they're willing to leave the grass on at 8 mils, and we've talked about this, so you know, let's just park that. Red ball cricket, they leave the grass on, but obviously the seam is harder and the ball stays harder, so it grips. So it's where the pink ball swings in Adelaide, it seams for the red ball. And I have always said playing the seaming ball is far harder when the ball's coming at the pace of in test cricket than the swing ball. You can line up for a swing ball. It's very hard when, you know, particularly these fast bowlers are magicians around the wobble seam, and often they don't know which way it's going to go. And so that just makes it very hard. And then you bring in finger spin that can grab in the thatchy grass. So it will be good to bat on, I expect, days 2 and 3, but it's more of a question of what damage has happened in that first day and who can either limit it or who can take advantage of it.
Yeah.
And it is it's a great place to bat once you get in. It's not the Adelaide. We know since the drop-in, it is not the Adelaide Oval of old. But that doesn't make it impossible to score big runs. But that's fascinating stats.
One thing surely that we're hoping on, there'll be less bounce, won't there? Like clearly than Brisbane and Perth.
More of a trampoline-y. So right. if you think about Brisbane and Perth, it's a nice, even, consistent pace to it. So the pace, what I'd describe as the pace matches the bounce. And so that's personally, as someone who grew up on wickets like that, that is batting heaven. If you can navigate the sideways early, that is get in and kind of fill your boots. The problem with Adelaide with the grass on the wicket is the ball sometimes gets caught in the grass. And so the ball might be coming at you and then bounces consistently, but more slowly, almost like you're facing a tennis ball. Yeah. And this is more like day one than two. And it,
like it
and
backs it up a little bit. Yeah.
It kind of is that kind of angle. And so what does that mean, I guess? That makes driving the ball really hard. Where in Perth and Brisbane, you can present the face, hit the ball late, and the ball will race off either through the covers or down the ground, and you get great value off the front foot. You actually don't need to try and hit the ball that hard. In Adelaide, unless it's right under your nose, as in long half volley, day one and probably up until lunch day two, driving is super high risk. You would park it and say, I'm waiting for them to hit more of back of a length and I'm just going to score off the back foot. And it might be slower going, but actually scoring off the back foot becomes easier because of the slow nature to slower tennis ball bounce. Use your horizontal and even 45-degree angle bats. And so in that sense, maybe it suits England. If they just park the drive for a little bit and say, we're gonna leave well because of that tennis ball bounce, you can leave on length well and know that it's not going to skid through and knock you over. If they leave well, I mean, this doesn't sound like the England process that we've seen so far. So I'm kind of fearing a little bit if they come out and say, oh, bugger it, we're going to throw our hands at everything. Look out, then you get a 36.
It's a great breakdown. I mean, look, and the way, look at what Travis Head does well. And basically, that's his own ground. There's a reason for that. It's a great way to look at it. There's been 700s across the 4 Shield games that have been played there so far this year. Jake Lehman's got 2 of them.
Backfoot player.
Yep. And I had a look through just how the games have been panned out. So the home team's only won one of them. There was one washout, and the only reason for that, they would have got a result. Day one was washed out completely. That was the West Australian game. The average first inning score, Teddy, sort of back up what you're saying, is 240. The average score in the second innings of the match is 375. Yeah. Yeah. And interestingly, in the three games that we got results, the side that batted second won all three.
There you go. I mean, that kind of play, thanks for kind of adding that little pepper in, because that's exactly how I see a game setting up. And that's, I mean, it suits England to a degree. They'll probably bowl first if they win the toss, toss.
That was my next question. So what are you doing?
100%. It's a bowl first wicket. But also, you can get in trouble if the game goes long enough and the ball's turning for the, you know, Nathan Lyon to come into the game there. But if you look through their batting lineup, you know, how do we see Zach Crawley play? Plonk the front foot, pile through your hands. That is like full red flag for this wicket. Yep. Pope, you know, has both but likes to do the same. So you then look at Root and you think, oh, you know, he's going to have to go big and he's in good form. But this actually suits Joe Root. He's not a huge front foot player. And Harry Brook, who knows what you're going to get. But you can kind of work out, and it kind of suits Duckett a little bit, you know, in the Jake Lehman mould, you know, a bit of a hangbacker. So it'll be a question, can Australia find their length to drag them forward? Can England resist the urge to throw their hands at anything that looks like it's 4.5 metres or fuller?
And the Aussies will bowl as well?
I don't think they will. I think they'll have a bat.
Okay. The other thing to keep in mind is the weather. So originally this was looking like heatwave prolonged the whole test match, and now it feels like it's only the first 3 days. Still going to be hot, don't get me wrong, but day one's 35. So win the toss and bowl, you're thinking, gee, that's hot. Keep in mind, day two's 39. So it gets hotter again on the second day. So it's almost like, hang on, do we stick them in, have a dip at them, hope we can try and get them out, take advantage of whatever's in the wicket, knowing that it's the last time he's going to get a drink for a few days, and you hope whatever kind of moisture's in there is going to be all right, and then hope that we can put the feet up and kick back on day two and bat the day. Not that that happens all that often in modern cricket. So
I think with that in mind, Australia winning the toss and bowling.
Yeah, there you go. So it makes sense. Yeah, 35, 39, 33, 29, 24. The overnight...
In the linen shorts? Well, what's your outfit going to look like?
Got the light pants, and you just bought me a nice linen shirt for Christmas, Teddy. So I've made sure that's in the suitcase. So
there we go. That's all I wanted to hear.
Be taking that. The overnight low on Wednesday, Thursday, the lowest it gets down to is 21 at night. So
brutal. I can't wait to watch it on the TV.
Proper heat.
Imagine, so, because they're one of the, what it must be, the Eastern stand, when you get the western afternoon sun. I've been there, I think it was the last actually, I thought I was going to melt.
Wow.
Literally into my seat. It was unbearable.
Yep. Five major time zones at the moment. The biggest question I get leading in is always, what time's it start? What time's it going on? It's 10 o'clock local time. So that's 10:30 Australian Eastern Daylight Time. So 10:30 for those of you in southeast of the country, where obviously the majority of the population lives. Your adjustments across the country, what's that? 9:30 for people in Queensland. Means it's going to be 9 a.m. for people in the Northern Territory. And for people in Perth, it's a 7:30 start. Last thing I want to mention about the test match is the two umpires in charge. So Nitin Menon, who we've seen throughout the series so far, he's the Indian umpire. He's going to partner with Ashan Raza, who's the Pakistani umpire. So we'll have one umpire from India, one umpire from Pakistan. Now, Ashan Raza is an interesting figure. He's a fascinating human interest story. He was actually part of the terror attacks in 2009. He was on the bus when that incident occurred in Pakistan and was critically injured and has made a miraculous recovery. And as a result, has obviously returned to umpire, and awesome to be able to see him now at this level on the ICC tour. He was also there for the incident between Bairstow and Carey. He was the umpire officiating at the time at Lord's. But Teddy, that's something we don't see all that often, a Pakistan and an Indian sort of umpiring together, given the tensions obviously between the countries in recent times. And nice to see we got two officials from two of the prominent cricket nations paired together.
It's fascinating. I mean, I'm sure Rick Finlay has a view. This, can't imagine it happens that often. It definitely hasn't happened since Handshake Gate. And so, you know, I wonder if, you know, as is courtesy at the start of games, when umpires go out, they wish each other good luck, they shake hands. My sense is that probably won't happen, and it's odd because people don't realise the umpires, they are a mini team. They work together. Third umpire and the two on-field umpires and the fourth umpire and the match, you know, the match officials are a team and they need to operate as such, and there's ways to make each other's job easier. There are ways to work together on the field, encourage them off the field, and to do that job in isolation for whatever reason, I think is not dysfunctional, but certainly suboptimal. Mm. And so I'm fascinated by this dynamic. I mean, who knows? They could be friends, but you know, the optics is that they can't be. Or that's a really interesting pickup that I'd kind of need to think more about how that can impact the game.
Yeah, I'll keep an eye on it. I'll see.
I'd love to see them shake hands and walk on the ground.
It'd be awesome.
I would honestly, that would warm my heart. I just doubt that it's going to happen.
Okay. So I'll be down there at the start of play, obviously, after the anthems when they take the field for the first time, Nitin Menon and Arshan Raza together on Wednesday.
I do wonder, sorry, just a side thought, the variation being, you know, umpires aren't contracted, or maybe they are, to the BCCI. I mean,
I think
contracted to the ICC. I don't know the exact nature of that relationship, but you can imagine if there is, you know, I think actually where I'm just talking around in circles, I don't think they're going to shake hands.
We'll see how it plays out. A couple of other little quick hits, Teddy. Everyone's talking. I'd love to get your reaction to some of this. Alex Carey saying, I love batting as high as possible. I do it in shield cricket, bat 5, even sometimes 4. He obviously batted 6 in front of Inglis. We obviously don't know what happens with the Australian team, but Usman Khawaja did media during the week. My feeling is he's going to play and he's going to bat in the middle order. What do you make of Alex Carey basically coming out and saying, yeah, I'll bat as high as I want in the lineup?
Maybe Usman should bat 7.
Well, that's what I raised on Friday.
I mean, that would be...
He's not going to bat there, is he?
But, well, I mean...
They did it to Inglis.
That's my point. I mean, I love... You kind of... It feels a bit of a loaded question. I personally would love to see Alex Carey walk out to bat ahead of Cameron Green. I think, you know, if he's physically up to that, you know, the nature of the right-hand, left-hand... breaks it up, he plays a different type of game. I mean, 6 is a great spot, 5's a great spot. I probably wouldn't bat him higher than that. If it was Usman at 7, is that tokenistic? Hey, Usman, we'll just let you sign off at 7 for a couple of test matches.
I feel like the only reason they put Josh there was almost to give them the out that, you know, if we need to change it, we can. I have no idea why Inglis didn't bat 5 or... whatever it turns out to be. Anyway.
We talked about that on Friday.
Usman said he's feeling 100%. Michael Hussey came out and said, look, it's not much of a decision for me. Khawaja back to open, head to 5. So Michael Hussey throwing support behind his former teammate there. And obviously we'll wait and see what happens at selection, whether Uzi's in the team or not. Any further thoughts on that, Teddy? I know we have covered it a fair bit over the last couple of pods.
You reckon we've covered it? I think they're somewhere between an hour and a half and 2 hours of content talking about this. I would keep the top 7 as it stood.
Yep. Cam Green did media too. Threw his manager under the shade. He was basically asked about his IPL status, where he was registered as a batter only, not an all-rounder. He said, look, I'll be able to bowl. There's no dramas about that. And that his manager basically stuffed up in the way that it was entered. He entered it as a batter as opposed to an all-rounder, and that's why he's in the wrong pod, but he has assured the IPL prospective buyers that he's available to bowl. So we'll see him do that.
Right in line with my theory that managers are absolutely not worth the paper to which you sign a contract with. I mean, just do the paperwork yourself, Cam.
Yeah.
Well, what are you doing? It's not yay, mate. Because you got to remember the IPL teams don't recognise player managers.
Right.
So there's no negotiation, there's no communication, et cetera, et cetera.
There's nothing built into the deal or any extras or anything like that. It's a mini auction on Tuesday night, starts at 8 p.m. Australian Eastern Daylight Time. Now, a mini auction takes place in the years where only a partial part of the squad is turned over, and then obviously the major auction, or the mega auction as they call it, is basically where you can only keep a few core players and then you change, you know, the whole face of the franchise and you draft multiple players. So what a mini auction means, Teddy, obviously there's less players that'll actually go, But I think, as you've spoken about in the past, that doesn't necessarily mean that the dollars are less, that this is the time, basically. If you're entered in a mini auction, there's less players available, teams are looking for someone to fit their particular need, and as a result, the prices can go up, up, up.
Yeah, well said. It's basic market mechanics of supply and demand, where often some teams have quite a bit of supply, as in cash, and there aren't many players to fill those holes. And so you get some odd outcomes, as you'd expect this time around. So I haven't been following it too closely, but maybe we can unpick it once it eventuates.
Dan Vettori leaves today, so he goes to Abu Dhabi. Obviously, he's the head coach at Sunrisers Hyderabad, so he'll be over there for that. Pat Cummins and Travis Head are already contracted to his team. So Steve Smith, Josh Inglis, Bo Webster, Jai Richardson, Cam Green. There's five Aussies in and around the test squad that are all up to go under the hammer. And then Atkinson, Duckett, Jamie Smith, Potts, Tung are all in the auction. So five for each squad, basically, for the Adelaide test that will have one eye on what happens on Tuesday night.
Green and Richardson are probably the only two Aussies that will get picked up, I reckon.
Mm. It's, Ravi Bishnoi, you know, the leg spinner from India, he's in it. He's expected to go for good money. Matisha Patharana, he's the new Malinga, the slinger from Sri Lanka. So he's also in it. Liam Livingston, Cam Green, you think will fetch big bucks, and Jamie Smith, all with a little bit of a watch on them heading into that auction on Tuesday night. All right, the BBL, Teddy, it's underway. I know everyone's probably sitting there listening to this podcast thinking, when are they going to get onto the Big Bash? I tuned in, saw this monsoonal weather in Perth. I thought, oh, there's no way they're possibly going to get a game. Instead, it was 11 overs aside, and the team which you had as your bold prediction to finish last, which I noticed someone tweeted you and already reminded you of, Scorchers won by 5 wickets in an 11-over game. They had the right side of the conditions. They batted second, and on the back of Cooper Conley, they got there to start 1-0.
They looked pretty good, didn't they?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, they did. I think the point is, in a shorter game, the team that bats second is always at a significant advantage. I didn't love what I saw from the Sixers with the ball, to be honest. They look short. A couple of bowlers. They're going to have to score some runs, by the looks of things. But it was awesome to have her back, mate. Cooper Conley. Wow. You could watch that kid bat. I mean, we're going to for the next 15 years. But just sublime. It feels like he's taken his game. It's hard after one innings. But just watching him, how he went about it, he's been a huge beneficiary to his time around the Australian team. And it also shows the gulf between international cricket and Big Bash cricket, because he looked way too good for Big Bash cricket last night, and we know he's still finding his feet in international cricket. But that was very entertaining. I stayed up and watched basically to watch him bat. So he's becoming box office.
He's like one guy that can completely change the face of this franchise, where you do naturally look at a bunch of them, you think, gee, they're getting a bit long in the tooth, and yet he's the centerpiece of the team. You put him at number three, he's dynamic in the field, he can bowl some overs. And then they've got the two guys that go at the top in Marsh and Allen. And then I actually really like Laurie Evans. I feel like he's the proper import that he sort of fits their needs. He's that guy that can bat at six, he's good in the field, he can go from ball one or he can rebuild an innings if you're in early trouble. So it all makes a lot of sense, and they've got the five bowling options: Agar, Paris, Couch, Beardman, and Hardy. The guys that aren't playing are interesting for me as well. So they won't get Morris at any stage; he won't play. Matt Kelly's had a really good start to the Shield season. Payne's sort of your handy, like, old county pro, whether he gets much of a look in at any stage. Richardson's a huge question mark. If he plays again, all of a sudden they look even better. And you'd think at some stage they're going to get Inglis, aren't they? That he's going to get to play some cricket for them. Maybe not, I guess, with the T20 World Cup coming up, and he's the first choice keeper there. But yeah, they're a nice unit.
We'll see where they finish. Let's not count chickens and all that.
It's one game. Sixers, they just never got going, did they? They lost wickets in overs 1, 3, 5, 6, and 10. And an 11-over game, if you're losing wickets that regularly, it makes it pretty hard. Bubba Azam, sort of more of a highlight on the field than with the bat. He made 2 or 5 balls and then leapt in the air and took a nice little hanger to dismiss Mitch Marsh overhead.
It was a great catch.
Yeah.
Excellent catch. Got me off my couch.
Love it.
He'll get some runs.
Yep. Renegades play the Heat, so that's coming up tonight. I did see a report on this. There was all these different options at the top of the order. They got Brown, Fraser, McGurk, Rizwan, Dixon, Jewell as to who opens the batting for them tonight, all in that 14-man squad. So they play the Heat, which includes Bartlett and Shaheen Shah Afridi. It's a cool day in Melbourne, but I'm hoping it won't rain. So it's 17 degrees at the moment. That's just an hour down the road in Geelong.
If it rains, don't they just close the roof?
No, it's in Geelong.
Oh, Geelong. Yeah. Sorry.
So down the road tonight. So
got it. Sorry.
Enjoy that at Kidinya Park. And then the Hurricanes take on the Thunder. So that's tomorrow. David Warner's raised the possibility of batting in the middle order, which is something we saw him do in the IPL. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I like that. I'd stick with that for sure. I think the risk with Warner is he gets knocked over by someone who, you know, he hasn't probably picked up a bat since the IPL. The talent is undoubted, but if, you know, Riley Meredith is cranking it up at 151, I'm telling you, you don't want a piece of that at 39 or 40 years of age. And so his most effective is to come in against medium paces, slog a couple of spinners, captain well, and get in and get going. So I think that probably suits the team anyway.
What's happening with the privatisation aspect? It feels like it's sort of slowed up a little bit. I saw Tristan Lovelett's column on Crick Info, where he was quoted as saying, some believe that even if privatisation goes ahead, it may not happen until after the current broadcast agreement expires in 2030-31. Gee, that's a long time away.
I don't know who Tristan's talking to. I think there's a gate coming pretty quickly in March, whether it's or May or, you know, in imminently, whether it's go or no go. And if it's go, it's probably within 12 or 24 months and you get on with it. If it's no go, then back to the drawing board.
Yeah, so we're still at that stage, despite the Boston Consulting Group, and we talked about it in July.
You can imagine there's lots of, at a high level, I think people conceptually understand it now, and so the next level is, okay, what are the negotiations that need to happen for states to agree with this? There's going to be some friction points. Who gets the money? What's the money going to be spent on? How's it going to be redistributed to grassroots? Let's get the detail, I imagine. And no one can really make a decision without that. So, you know, they've done some very good modelling. It's been excellent work. The next question is, actually, what does the fine print look like? What are people signing up to? Because you're going to need to know that before you then say, hey, yeah, this is a great idea.
Yeah, the states don't agree on anything, though. Like, is this all going...
I don't agree with that. I think they all have different interests.
Is this all going to rest on whether the states say, yeah, we agree or not? And if it all gets too hard, is there a chance they just go, don't worry about it, we won't sell it?
100%. Well, it's not a question of being too hard, but there will be a question of how money is distributed and what's the equity around that.
Which is fair enough, because you've only got one chance to do it, don't you?
That's exactly right. So you get it right up front and get everyone on the same page. I think generally, and I'm not speaking either out of school, or I get a feeling that people will actually like the idea because they understand that something is required to fix the balance sheet in Cricket Australia, and it's not going to be media rights currently, and it's not going to be other revenue streams. And so here it is.
All right. The WBBL champions are the Hobart Hurricanes. So they now hold both the Big Bash crowns for the men and the women on the back of Lizelle Lee, highest score ever in a final. So 77 not off 44 balls. They restricted the scores just to 137 and then ran them down, losing only two wickets in the process. So well done to the Hobart Hurricanes. Comprehensive win.
It was. They gave him an absolute touch-up. And, of course, I think it's worth calling out a fine way for Elise Villani to finish her career captaining a Big Bash title. You forget some of these, you know, generational players for Australia. She's won T20 World Cups.
Yep.
I think she's won 50 over World Cups. She's won three state titles for Tasmania. And this was kind of just a missing piece to a pretty illustrious career. So awesome to see her to go out with that.
And then someone like Lauren Smith, who's now won four at three different franchises, and so she collects another one here with the Hurricanes. I think we said it right at the start of the tournament. In US sport, they talk about this as like a get-off-the-bus team. And what they basically mean is when they get off the bus, you look at them and go, holy smokes, we've got to play that team today. And the whole way through, so Lee and Wyatt Hodges, as she is now, Siva Brunt, Carey, Villani, Graham, Strano. Like, it is a proper star-studded lineup that they've been able to get together. And a lot of players, like you said, like Villani and Lazelle Lee, who were once the superstars of the team, who now drop back on that next rung as such, and yet they're still putting out top-level performances. So to be able to get that blend of your old stars, your new stars, and everything in between, it's great list construction.
Excellent list construction. And the only thing I'd add to that is I think partly, the overseas players to this WBBL were probably, I'd say, unders on expectation. And you can imagine coming in from a World T20 tournament.
Yeah.
People were tired, emotional. A few looked, to be honest, like they wanted to go home. Except for the English girls who don't want to go home to winter in England. And so I think that the three internationals that the Hurricanes had are all English. And so they're like, bugger this. This is heaps better than being back in the snow.
And Nat Silverbrant's probably the best cricketer in the world, isn't she? So
it's a good pub debate. I don't know that to be true, but I know that she's a very bloody good cricketer.
It also means the Melbourne Stars are still the only team yet to win a BBL or a WBBL crown. They're the only team that haven't won either. And Beth Mooney, a little hat tip to her too. I saw this stat: 5 of the last 6 editions of the tournament, she's been the leading run scorer. Mm. 5 out of the last 6, like unbelievable numbers. Averages 47 in the WBBL in that time for a proper superstar of the game. I didn't think overall, as a cricket fan and as someone that's covered a lot of the WBBL, I didn't think it was a great edition of the tournament. And maybe what you're saying plays into that. I thought, just the ability to follow along, interest levels, look at the crowd the other night, was soft. I don't know. It's had some really great editions, and I've been lucky enough to cover a lot of those finals. Even last year had this big upswing at the end where the Renegades won, and the Josie Dooley story is the backdrop, and it was played at the MCG and everything else. Whereas this year I sort of felt a little bit like, oh, yeah, sort of what were the, when you get to the end of the tournament, what were the moments where you thought, oh, wow, that was awesome, or look at the, remember that moment or that innings or that catch? I don't know. There's very few that sort of stick in the memory other than good on the Hurricanes for winning.
Yeah, I agree with that. It was probably not particularly memorable. I mean, the standard of cricket was good without being great. I thought the fielding probably let a few games down as a whole. And I just get the sense that we got to move it to align with the men's Big Bash. I just think it's bloody hard at that time of year to get the support it deserves, because the world's best cricketers are here, and they deserve people being able to follow. I think there were moments that probably shot the tournament shot itself in the foot, be it the rain in Adelaide when they walked off with 3 to win, the roller and the ball and the roller saga. There are little moments, you're like, there were more moments.
Correct.
Than, oh my God, moments.
And it does become a victim of its own high expectation, but I mean, this is what we want, don't we? We want that to be the expectation, that it's high and it continues to make that.
The Thunder played the Sixers North Sydney Oval on a Sunday afternoon, and there were, 8,000 people there. Whatever the number was, it was absolutely pumping. You're like, this should be the tournament.
Yep.
And then how do we make every game that? How do we get clubs to invest in that experience?
Yeah. Great. Did you ever play Durham Charlotte just before we go?
I didn't.
No. I noticed there was a T20 there last night. I know you love these bilateral series taking place, 5-game series between India and South Africa. India 2-1 up. All 3 games have been like lopsided fixtures, and so it was again last night where India won by 7 wickets. But Shukri Conrad, who's the coach, of course, of the Proteas, was quoted as saying during the week, I've had to cancel a meeting because our guys are on a hike in the mountains somewhere, which I just thought is, doesn't that just sum up beautifully what we love about Durham Charlotte? Why wouldn't you be doing that rather than attending a meeting?
Base in the Himalayas.
Yes.
Have the team meeting at the top of the mountain. What are you doing?
Yeah. How good. India's record, by the way, they're 27-4. 27 wins, 4 losses since last World Cup. So they got a pretty good team there assembling home conditions, and I know the Aussies have got a great little crew together as well, but India, I'm sure, still the team to beat for the World Cup early in the new year. Teddy, appreciate your time as always. Have a great week. I will chat to you from Adelaide at the completion of the test. Of course, we're on every Monday and Friday and after every day's play. So great to be able to come on here and chat a little cricket with you for an hour.
Love the call. Thanks.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.